CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talks Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the independent private sector lobby group and business networking club, Downtown Liverpool in Business. And every Sunday, I'll be taking a look at some of the week's big business stories and talking to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider Northwest region. This week, Ethel Austin went into administration with the loss of around 1,500 jobs, many of them in Merseyside. So much for the recession being over. Meanwhile, the world of football appears to be creating a recession all of its own. Locally, Chester City are so skint that they've been unable to meet their policing costs. Premier League Portsmouth and Championship side Cardiff City have also found themselves under threat of administration this week. I'll be talking to a top football finance expert to ask what is going on. On a more positive note, solicitors Brabner's Chafe Street and accountants Grant Thornton have become the latest big city firms to sponsor the Shanghai Expo. Town centre shops have been given a boost with the announcement that their business rates will be cut. And Liverpool is set to host another fantastic international tennis tournament this summer. In May, Liverpool's political landscape may be dramatically transformed. The Tories are tipped to win power at Westminster for the first time in 13 years, whilst locally, many predict that Labour will be in charge at Liverpool Town Hall. I'll be joined in the studio by Labour's deputy leader, Councillor Paul Brandt, to find out what Labour would mean to business in Liverpool. First, the business of football. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Tom Cannon, professor at Liverpool University and the chief executive of Ideopolis International. Tom, welcome.
Hello, Frank.
Well, we spoke a few weeks ago, Tom, about problems that were being stored up by football clubs in a financial sense. But I don't think I imagine that the warnings that you were giving out would come to pass so quickly. It's been a disastrous week for the game, hasn't it?
Well, financially, this has been accelerating. The more people have become aware of the scale of the debt, and of course, as you said very early in your introduction, the recession hasn't kind of been transformed suddenly into a boom, but basically what you're finding is that, particularly the Inland Revenue, are finding that they're having to put the squeeze really hard on high-profile businesses like football clubs.
Is that because of the overall recession? And obviously the Treasury now is having to find money itself, isn't it? You know, we're in this financial debt as a nation. And of course, if the taxman is owed millions and millions of pounds from a particular industry sector, it can't just keep ignoring that, can it?
Absolutely. And the fact that football's so high profile doesn't help. But if you start with the Inland Revenue, I mean, we know now that the figures for debt to the revenue, what people owe the revenue, have increased in 2007-2008. Outstanding debts to the revenue were just under £3 billion. In 2008-09, that had increased tenfold to just short of £30 billion. So in that kind of climate, when the government squeezed desperate for money, if you see an industry like football, which on the one hand seems to be spending money like there's no tomorrow, and on the other hand, turning to the revenue and saying, well, actually, there is a tomorrow, but we can't pay you. Mm.
I suppose what people will say, Tom, is they look at Chester City and even the Portsmouths and Cardiffs in this world, and they think, well, actually, it's never going to happen to, you know, Manchester United or Liverpool, or even perhaps a Birmingham City sat mid-table in the Premiership. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't think it's a fair assessment at all. I think it's a very dangerous assessment. Because if you just look at the Northwest, something like half of all English football's debts are in the Northwest. Depends a little bit on how you count the debt, but let's say the total debt of the English Premiership is between 2.5 and 2.8 billion. Half of that is in the Northwest, 1.4 billion, and a billion of it is between two very, very famous big football clubs, Liverpool and Manchester United. And as interest rates may go up in the next few months, you find that those clubs are going to be struggling to repay their interest charges. And the minute either of them topples from this incredible level of success they've both achieved in revenue, particularly from Europe, is the moment that they're going to feel the squeeze.
So does that mean Liverpool's qualification for the Champions League is almost essential?
Liverpool are such a big club globally and are such a successful club historically that they could probably cope with a year out of the Champions League. But if it became a recurrent pattern, if, for example, Manchester City replaced any team that's currently in the top four, apart from Chelsea, because Abramovich got rid of their debt by turning it to equity, any one of the top four who dropped on a regular basis out of the Champions League, missing out on that 30 to 40 million a year, would face problems, whether it was Manchester United, Liverpool or Arsenal.
How does the current financial climate affect Everton then? I mean, that's a club that has been seeking an investor for almost a decade now. Bill Kenwright seems to have a relatively steady ship there. But nonetheless, it must be worrying times for all clubs. And Everton's failure to secure a move to a new stadium surely puts it under financial pressure as well.
Well, the truth is Everton's debts are manageable. The reality is that with a club like Everton, the sale of a high-profile player, 25, 30 million, would halve Everton's debt. So it's a manageable amount of money, whether it's 60, 70 or 75 million. When are those kind of levels? If you've got the players you can sell or some kind of new transaction. The problem is when you get to Manchester United's scale of debt, 700 million pounds plus over $1 billion. That's when it becomes, frankly, even if you sold Wayne Rooney at the top of the market, 70 million, as they did this summer, it doesn't make much of a dent even because the debts are so great. But the truth is, it's never comfortable to carry that level of debt. And the risk all the time, and why Pompey's situation is important, is because two things happen. One, it exposes the scale. And then the other thing it is, it forces a degree of transparency, which seldom exposes good news in football.
How have they been allowed to build up these levels of debt, Tom? I mean, if you're running a business on a day-to-day basis now, the banks are so on people's backs. You know, I was talking to a guy yesterday who actually went £5 overdrawn and was getting telephone calls from his bank manager. How have football clubs been able to mount this sort of debt?
Well, I think there are three reasons. First of all, there has been the volume flow. The reality is, whatever people say about Liverpool and Manchester United as the two most indebted clubs in the Northwest, they are capable of servicing their debt. At the moment, Liverpool are under far less pressure than people pretend or talk about because they can service their debt. They can pay their interest charges. It's, in a sense, almost like having an interest-only mortgage. And so long as you can do that, the banks are content. Second, they are incredibly high profile. Nobody wants to make an enemy of Liverpool supporters or Manchester United supporters if that involves in commercial transactions. That's what makes the revenue so important, because nobody likes them anyway. So they are not going to lose any love, but a bank, a building company, any one of the other suppliers, they don't want the antipathy, the hostility that would be associated with the kind of action that the revenue are now taking against Portsmouth, against Cardiff City, against all these other clubs, because they don't worry about their image in the way that a bank or someone else would do.
Do you think the forthcoming election post that, do you think actually the revenue will become even more aggressive?
Absolutely. I mean, the revenue have a reasonable case. They owed an awful lot of money. And people who aren't football fans might say, well, is it possible that revenues that are needed for hospitals, for policing, for defence are being spent, or in a sense not earned, from multi-millionaire football clubs or billionaire football owners?
I suppose we all know and read about the Portsmouths of this world, but locally, as I mentioned in the intro there, Chester City are facing possible extinction. Do you see any way back for the Chesters?
I find it very hard to see in the current climate, because although it's people like the revenue or the police who are having to ask for the money, the income flows are drying up. The small business that might have sponsored a game or sponsored a player is turning around and saying, well, if the company's not going to be there, if the club's not going to be there, why should I risk my sponsorship money? Anyway, times are tough. You've just talked about somebody who's got a £5 overdraft. If you're in that kind of situation and you're a small business, you're looking around and you're saying, well, do I really want to sponsor a player, take an executive box, bring five or six people along to a game? And don't forget, quite a lot of the money that goes into our northwestern clubs, particularly those ones, is actually coming from the public sector. It's surprising how much of the sponsorship income or the executive box and the other facilities are sponsored by local government and others. And they're simply not going to be able to do it in the future.
Where does this all end then, Tom? Are we heading to hell in a handcart, or will the game simply have to restructure and streamline like so many other industry sectors have had to do?
I think it's almost certainly going to have to restructure and streamline. In a sense, there are two scenarios. Either somebody like Portsmouth actually is wound up, and I think the knock-on effect of somebody like Portsmouth being wound up, that is closed down, liquidated, all the assets sold by the official receiver, then I think that would have a knock-on effect and could possibly bring the house of cards down. At the moment, if you talk to people in the game, what they tend to say is no club's gone under, therefore no club will go under. One club goes under and suddenly that edifice has every risk of collapsing. Then I think you'd get a serious shrinkage. Would there be 92 clubs left in English football, professional? I doubt if you could sustain 60 or 70 on the current financials.
Tom, as always, fascinating to talk to you. I'm sure it's a subject we'll return to in future weeks. Thanks very much.
Real pleasure, Frank.
Thanks, Tom.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Right, well, one of the things that I mentioned in my introduction is the fact that despite the official statistics of the UK coming out of recession, a number of companies are still struggling, not least Ethel Austin, that went into administration this week. Downtown Liverpool recently organised an event which was suggesting that often companies scrap marketing strategies in the time of struggle, and that is the very time they should be investing, particularly in the area of new technology. I'm delighted to have on the line Brian Adams, who's the Managing Director of PH Creative, a full-service internet marketing agency that's been based in Liverpool for 6 years and has had a very, very successful time. Indeed, Brian won the Downtown Liverpool Young Entrepreneur of the Year award last year. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Frank.
Perhaps you can just describe to the listeners what PH Creative actually offers as a service.
Yeah, sure, no problem at all. I suppose essentially what we do, Frank, is first and foremost, we get to know the businesses we're working with and try and get a really good feel for what their business objectives are. I suppose it's quite easy to put our agency in the box of a web design company, but quite quickly when people come to see us, they find that they're answering a lot more business questions than anything about websites and design and that kind of thing. And I suppose that's born from over 6 years of experience from trying to make our clients happy with websites, and really what makes them happy is if you can help them with the business. So we've evolved from a web design company into a full-service internet marketing agency purely because what people are interested in is more business and marketing assistance. And the essence of what we do, it boils down majority of the time, unless it is e-commerce and sort of box shifting, as I call it, and just making sales. Most businesses that we engage with need a little bit more help meeting more people and lead generation. So I suppose what we do is we turn strangers into 20-minute meetings. We look at what people are searching for. We bring them to our clients' websites, and quite simply, we give them what they're looking for and turn a visitor, a hit, a statistic, into a real tangible contact. So the idea is we turn your marketing, your online marketing strategy round from just hoping people call you up or leave an inquiry to finding out who people are so you can proactively market to them going forward. But what you can boil it down to, we turn strangers into 20-minute meetings.
Do you get the feeling that businesses actually appreciate the power of the internet and website marketing nowadays. I know lots of people are aware of, you know, you Google a company and the image and the design of your website is important. Yeah. And I think most people get that these days. But I sense that some of the things that you're talking about and some of the other work that you do around search engine optimization and, you know, social networking and those sorts of issues,
yeah,
I still get the feeling that business owners in particular in the SME sector don't quite get what that is all about.
Yep, yep, absolutely. I mean, I've certainly seen a learning curve over the last 2 or 3 years where business owners, they would acknowledge that they needed a website, but perhaps didn't really know why. And I think it goes back to the times that they liken it to a brochure. So people will go on and just have a look at your site and get some information. But now, especially when marketing spend counts, you know, when every penny counts, online marketing, it's accountable. For the first time ever, you'll make a marketing investment and you can see exactly what you've spent your money on and where the return is. And that learning curve has come from, I think, marketplaces become more competitive, so you've got to do more and you can see tangible results. So whereas people relied on the big old yellow dusty book, the yellow pages, I think now business owners, because they can see more tangible returns from online marketing, certainly we've seen over the last couple of years that you know, they're engaging a lot more with online marketing because they can see the return. There's certainly a lot more that can be done. The average business, we go in, we see it every day. The average business are missing tricks left, right and centre to leverage their brand they've worked so hard for over years and years, and the opportunities. Because online, people are searching for you. You're not necessarily doing all the selling. People are actually engaging because they want to buy. So the opportunities are absolutely fantastic. And you touched on social media there. Last year, you know, at the start of the year, we were talking about social media, and I think it is a learning curve. It takes an education process with the average small business owner to see, well, okay, how does that fit into my business model and how does that make a difference to my bottom line? But just in the space of 12 months last year, we were certainly seeing that more SMEs were willing to engage. They perhaps didn't quite know why they were doing it. It was just the sort of latest thing that businesses were doing. But towards the end of the year, we were, you know, demonstrating more and more the power and the leverage of engaging with social media. And especially when you boil it down to exactly what it is, it's just new channels, new ways of making new introductions to new people, new opportunities, and leveraging the fact that you can put one message out there and reach, you know, a huge audience.
Mm. It's about communication, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Communication is key. I mean, most business owners now are aware of search engine optimization, probably because I think most businesses now are plagued with at least 2 or 3 calls a week with businesses ringing up saying, I can get you to the top of Google. Mm. So, you know, that's certainly a sort of awareness now that you need to be visible in the search engines. But going back to the point of how does it affect your bottom line, it's okay being in these search engines. It's okay having a great website. But how much money is it making your business on a monthly basis? So what we focus on is conversion. Mm. You know, it's okay bringing hundreds, thousands of people to your shop window a month. How many people are spending? You know, and what's the tactic to make more people spend more money next month? Mm. But it's great opportunities, because usually when we go into a business, there's opportunities that we can see straight away. There's ways that we can make an immediate difference. But the real value is, of course, understanding the business model, their target audience, what effective language turns them on, what are they really looking for, how can you help them best, how can you give them great value, and use that as a strategy to make your website work harder month on month.
Yeah, I suppose the way I've always viewed our website at Downtown Liverpool, which we do, as you know, spend an awful lot of time on, is that initially, yeah, it was the shop front. But then when you look at the other marketing opportunities available, particularly you mentioned earlier the Yellow Pages, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, once you put your advert in that, it's in there. You know, you can't change it, you can't be flexible. Whereas with a website and an online facility, if you're clever and sophisticated enough and you're prepared to work at it a little bit, you can actually alter your messages and update and modernise your outlook. And I think sometimes, you know, the problem that a lot of businesses have out there is they pay a significant amount of money to have a website and then just leave it static on there for years and years.
That's right. You know, and I liken it to buying a car. Most people think they make this big investment. And if you think of a website like a car, it's a big investment, and you've just bought this new shiny website, and you think that's it. Now, the expectations are starting to change. You know, the value, the investment you've made in all that upfront cost, to protect that investment, you've got to be prepared to market your website. So if a website was a car, what most business owners are just getting switched on to the fact that if you've got to be prepared to put petrol in that car every month. Otherwise, you're not going to get from A to B. You know, if you don't market your website, it's just a great big box of potential. It's the best kept secret. You know, and if you've invested in something, you know, where's the plan to get your return on investment? And when you've got the likes of social media, you've got Facebook, Twitter, and all of these new channels, all these ways of reaching more people, you know, and everything you do is tangible, accountable, and measurable. Mm. You know, doesn't it just make sense that you start utilizing what you've got and make it work for your business? Mm. So you're absolutely right. But there's the good news is, you know, every business we go in, we typically find ways and means of making an instant improvement. And, you know, I'm putting that long-term strategy into place. And I do think that the majority of business owners now, when the Yellow Pages man knocks on the door, it's a much harder sell.
Mm. Just finally, Brian, how do you find people react to Twitter and Facebook if you say to them, you need to get involved in this? Does the typical business owner respond?
Well, again, I think this is starting to change. But it's a case of, you know, I haven't got time for this. You know, where does this fit in to my business model? But again, it's an education process. So part of the integration of social media and all of these activities are making it manageable, achievable, and then as soon as you start to demonstrate the returns to the business owner, then guess what? They're a lot more interested. They're a lot more turned on, and suddenly Facebook
starts making a bit of sense.
Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Listen, Brian, thanks very much for joining me today. Been
my
great
pleasure.
Speaking to you. That's Brian Adams, the Managing Director of PH Creative. Thanks,
Brilliant.
Brian.
Thanks, Frank.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Well, as I said earlier, Labour are looking to take control of Liverpool City Council for the first time in over a decade. I'm delighted that I'm joined in the studio by the deputy leader of the Labour Group, Paul Brandt.
Hello.
Paul, welcome. I suppose from a business perspective, we would ask, what can we expect if Labour does indeed come to power in May?
Well, you can expect a number of things from us. First of all, honesty about the state of the City Council's finances. Secondly, support from within the framework within which we operate, be it the national government framework and, of course, what the local framework and finances allows us to do. And partnership arrangements. We want to make sure we work with the business in the city, both to preserve and protect what we've got, but also to allow new businesses to come forward and flourish and hopefully attract inward investment from outside the city region and also hopefully internationally.
Mm. This issue of inward investment interests me because it seems to me that on occasion we've actually not done as well as we might in terms of having all our ducks in a row when opportunities have been made available. I mean, I think about the Ministry of Justice, for example. You know, I know that's government investment, but nonetheless, the sort of jobs that that could bring, civil service relocation into the provinces. And we started way behind Manchester. We've subsequently caught up because of efforts, not least from people like Joe Anderson and others. Yes. But why is it that we don't seem to have that cohesion and coordination that other cities have?
I think we need to plan ahead, not just one step from where we are, but two or three steps, and see the opportunities that are coming over the horizon more effectively. And that's a combination of being engaged with partners who will also be able to help identify them with you, and also having the capability within the council to make sure that we build up those partnerships and put the packages in place. The Manchester situation regarding the Ministry of Justice relocation is a perfect example. We've all known for a long time that Whitehall is under pressure to relocate its staff and certain services outside of the high-cost London region. And what Liverpool should have been doing, in my view, the City Council certainly should have been involving itself in assembling packages of land and packages of grant with organisations such as the North West Development Agency and European Union, so that we could go to central government and say, look, we understand you have this particular desire to relocate. Here we are, we've got the land for you, we've got the willingness as an authority to deliver, and we've got some financial package assembled all in one go. Come to Merseyside, come to Liverpool, we've got fantastic people, we've got a well-trained workforce, we've got good infrastructure links, we've got everything that you need to be able to relocate here. And if we can do that, you're not presenting your potential partners with a problem, you're presenting them with a solution. You're saying, we want to work with you. And it's that kind of can-do attitude that perhaps Liverpool needs to work harder at. Because if in many respects, Manchester has been dealing in that way for a long period of time, both on its own and collectively through the organisation known as AGMA, the Greater Manchester collection of local authorities, where they will often do a bit of horse trading and come up with a collective approach on the way forward, which delivers more for the Greater Manchester area than any one of them could do if they were acting alone.
This brings me on to something that the business community gets terribly frustrated and confused about, which is the number of agencies that seem to be involved in Liverpool's regeneration and tourism sale and image and all that sort of thing. So the two that spring to mind are Liverpool Vision and the Mersey Partnership. Now, for me, they undertake very, very similar roles, and rather than being complementary, often seem to either be competing or, worse, it's sort of after you clawed approach. You know, actually, it's not the TMP's job, the Mersey Partnership. It's Vision, or Vision will say, well, actually, that's a Mersey Partnership situation. And I think that partly happened with the Ministry of Justice initiative. Where does Labour sit as far as those two organisations are concerned? Does it make any sense, in your view, to have both of those organisations running alongside one another? Wouldn't it be better and easier if they merged?
I think, as with any structures that you have, the key measure of whether you want to keep those structures or change them is whether or not they are delivering in the environment which they operate. Whatever happens after May, the likelihood is that we are going to be facing, if we haven't already had it, a new government of whatever political colour, with new priorities reflected in their manifesto commitments. We will be facing a changed regime in terms of regional investment. The Tories, if they win, have said they want to get rid of the RDAs, although it's very unclear what they're intending to do about the North West Development Agency. The role of the local authorities may be changed in terms of their planning powers, regional spatial strategy documents. So the first thing to say is it's almost a little early now to say what are the right organisations we need to have in place to meet the challenges that may be presented by that new regime and new structures that are in place after the election. However, I think you're right that one of the key things that business wants is clarity about who to go to, and inward investors really would like a single one-stop shop, if I can slightly abuse the phrase, to know where to come to. So do you, if you want to invest in Liverpool, go to the Regional Development Agency? Do you go to Westminster, Whitehall? Do you come to the local authority? Do you go to Liverpool Vision? So there needs to be an increased degree of clarity about that. We've met with both, as you'd imagine, met with both Liverpool Vision and also the Moses Partnership. Liverpool Vision's origins, of course, are the first urban regeneration company in the country, and it was set up or at arm's length to the City Council, but with an attempt to ensure that there was a business facing front to the City Council, which could add value to things that the council wasn't already able to do, or perhaps more importantly, the business sector felt that the council, that they wouldn't go to the council for, even if the council felt it could do them. The Mersey Partnership and Liverpool Vision both believe that they do different things and that they do them through different funding streams and they do them in different ways. But I wouldn't want to close off the option of saying we need to look at all of the structures we have in place after the election, because at the end of the day we are going to be working in an environment, whoever wins, with constrained public finances, with an increasing degree of competition for inward investment, and with, compared to what we've got used to in Liverpool here, a much more limited degree of European investment capacity. So we will have to raise our game, frankly, and whatever it takes to raise the game, whatever it takes to deliver better outcomes for people, it's what works is what counts, and people want to see us with a city that is working, both in terms of its existing business and improving further investment.
I mean, you've inferred there, Paul, that Liverpool and the wider city region have benefited greatly over the past decade and beyond from that big public sector investment. So objective one, supplemented by some big government spending in Liverpool as well. That finishes. We then have a squeeze on public expenditure anyway, because, as you say, whoever wins the next election will have to start to tackle the UK PLC deficit. And yet, you and the Liberal Democrats are proposing a council tax freeze for the forthcoming year. And I suppose what most people out there are thinking is, can we actually afford to not increase council tax this year when we know those problems are mounting? Less investment from central government, less investment from Europe, pressure on the number of businesses that are going to be paying council tax, a population fall in Liverpool predicted. Are we not simply storing problems up for ourselves in the future with a council tax freeze this year?
As always, in setting council tax levels, you've got a number of different competing priorities. The council, of course, has an almost bottomless pit of potential calls on its expenditure, especially in a city like Liverpool, where there are enormous unmet needs. On the other hand, many of the people in Liverpool are struggling. Many hard-working families are struggling on relatively modest wages, and they're having to meet rental payments or mortgage payments in relation to their properties, and of course to pay some or all of the council tax. We took the view that this year, because of the difficult position that many of those families are in, and the fact that we are in the third and final year of the current comprehensive spending review settlement from central government, which is exceptionally generous for Liverpool, that the City Council, in striking the balance, the right thing for it to do was to set a no rise. We could afford to do it this year, and families in Merseyside and Liverpool needed it. However, you are right to say that whilst it doesn't cause a problem this year, what we do know is happening in future years is that Liverpool has got a huge yawning gap in its anticipated expenditure compared to its anticipated income. The city treasurer has told the council that over a five-year period, that difference is £120 million. And indeed, the chief executive has written to various members of staff in the council saying that it's not £120 million over 1 year. It will have to be dealt with over a period of years. And that's part of the reason why negotiations took place with the unions to suggest anything up to 1,000 redundancies. We, however, feel that there were some strict dividing lines between us and the Liberal Democrats this year, not just in terms of the council tax levels, But the government gave Liverpool an additional £2.8 million just at the end of last year in what's called known as area-based grant. And we said that we wanted to allocate £1 million of that to create a regeneration, housing-based regeneration fund in which entities could bid and kickstart geographical regeneration, predominantly primed by housing regeneration, to increase the number of social homes in the city, but also to enable local regeneration of physical areas of decline to take place, for example, in the Boot Estate, or there's a project in my ward on Great George Street where a series of flats have been left vacant and derelict for many, many years just because there's a very small funding gap between which would allow the project to be brought into play and to improve a major gateway into the city centre. In addition to that, we would focus the funding in two areas where local jobs would be generated, in particular in the construction sector. So our view was that, yes, £1 million is a lot, but it's important to deliver more affordable homes, more local jobs and physical regeneration. Now, the Lib Dems voted against us on that, and that's their prerogative, and they won the vote because they currently run the council. But our view is that regeneration, more homes and creating local jobs would be major ways of stimulating the city's business sector.
In terms of that housing regeneration fund, which sounds to me to be a very innovative move on behalf of the council or the Labour group on the council, would that be a regeneration project that you would look to undertake in partnership with the private sector? Would you be looking to work with housing associations? Are there opportunities, I suppose I'm asking, Paul, for some private Liverpool property developers who have had a hard time over the past 18 months for 2 years to get involved in these sorts of initiatives?
The answer is yes. This was a fund of money set aside for people to bid into. So we would expect or hope to receive bids from, of course, housing associations, but also private landowners, and very possibly partnerships between the two, and maybe third sector organisations, voluntary sector organisations who would have plans of their own. And we would require them to show good value for money, but also require them to demonstrate that they were creating or protecting local jobs and employment. And therefore, we had the greatest possible hope of making sure that the money circulated in the local economy, doing the best possible benefit for Liverpool as a home. We also had a pledge to create 100 apprentices. That's 100 apprentices created directly by the council as a itself. There were funded positions, and we would have funded that out of the additional £2.8 million that I mentioned earlier of area-based grant, because we take the view that youth unemployment is one of the most pernicious ways of disempowering and sometimes disenfranchising some of our young people, and it's essential that we make sure that they are introduced early into the world of work. And some of the psychological studies show that people who suffer significant periods of unemployment very early on in their life, it makes them much less likely to be able to get into employment later on in life. It destroys some of their confidence. And we all know that raising the skill level and capacity for employment of the workforce here in Liverpool is a major factor in making sure that the city is fit for fully into the 21st century. So we would expect not only the council to be creating those 100 apprentices, but anybody who bids into that £1 million housing pot to be demonstrating local jobs. But we would like to see local apprentices formed as well as part of those schemes. Mm.
And that will again potentially involve the local private sector.
Absolutely.
In terms of being able to offer apprenticeships and at least in part utilising that fund. Yes. The local Labour thing always fascinates me, because we've been banging on about this as an organisation downtown Liverpool for many years now, and you will have heard last week Paul Flanagan's comments about the fact that, you know, out of all the regeneration and construction work that's taken place in the city centre, nonetheless an awful lot of those jobs seem to have been exported out, rather than the indigenous firms that are here being able to win that work. And when I speak to the people who deal with procurement, which is a nightmare of a process in fairness to them, but also you talk to some housing associations who've done a lot of work in the city, and other people as well. It seems to me that what the public sector are saying is that in Liverpool, there simply aren't the size of company that they feel comfortable with to just give some of these bigger contracts to. And therefore, they feel more confident in offering those contracts to national companies with much bigger balance sheets and turnovers, which then often result in those national companies simply subcontracting that out to local firms. And the cash flow of those local firms then begins to suffer, and there's markup and all that sort of thing. How do we get round those procurement arrangements, Paul? Is it just something that politicians and local officials talk about and actually can't in the end deliver?
As always in a problem involving procurement, there's a number of competing complexities. One of them is that any contract which is let by a public body, which of course includes a council, above a certain level, has to be publicly procured through the European Union procurement rules. And that's to enable everybody to have a fair crack at the whip. And the idea is that it provides best value for money for local public sector organisations, and more importantly, the council taxpayers and the public that they serve. And in principle, I don't think anyone has a problem with that. The difficulty that some people have, the organisations locally, you mentioned particularly smaller scale ones, is that very often if you're letting a contract worth 50 million or so, however capable you may think Mr. A is, if Mr. A is setting up a one-man band who's never done any work before, doesn't have any assets on the balance sheet, doesn't have any history of turnover, the truth is it's a pretty precarious act to enter into a contract with just that individual, because as we've all become more used to in the banking age, counterparty risk, as it's described, is a major fear. So most bodies want to contract with an entity which is a pretty solid and has a bit of history to it, and if necessary has the financial resources to fall back on if they need to in the course of the contract. So normally when letting a very big contract, the procurers will require the company tendering to have a certain degree of turnover, and that's there to protect people and so that temporary transient shell companies can't be set up which can then be folded if for one reason or another it seems that they've tendered a little bit too low for the contract or they've misunderstood the complexity of delivery. I think you're absolutely right, and your callers and your correspondents are right to say that should not constrain the local sector, particularly SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, from being able to bid. And I think there are ways around it, and some of them I would postulate are as follows. We need to make sure that there is a facility and indeed almost an obligation on people who receive or are contracted in those large-scale contracts to subcontract out other elements, because, of course, those subcontracts are not governed by the European tender rules because they are not themselves public procurement processes. They are purely private ones. Secondly, I think we need to make sure that in that original procurement that we make as part of the tendering process, as part of the specification, it clear that what the council wants to get out of this is local employment and capturing as much of the economic turnover generated by the money flowing around within Merseyside as possible, and that therefore that the tenders will be awarded not just based on price but based on quality, and part of the quality is obviously the direct service delivery, but also the ability to recycle jobs and money within Liverpool and Merseyside as a whole. I was very struck when I met a couple of local businessmen a few months ago who said they very often would have liked to have tendered for highway resurfacing work, which the council, of course, is the lead contractor for. And they were too small to qualify for the single large tender that took place, but they had been able to, through procurement arrangements with Enterprise Liverpool, to be the subcontractors for a significant proportion of that work. And that seemed to me to be working relatively well. However, Enterprise Liverpool, it appeared, for whatever reason, or it's unclear, that arrangement had fallen by the wayside and they found themselves in a position where they were no longer able to capture that work. Now, I think the City Council has an obligation where it is the major, the lead procuring partner in those arrangements to make sure that pressure is continually put on its partners. And Enterprise Liverpool, of course, is partly owned by Liverpool City Council as a joint venture. So we need to be constantly vigilant to make sure that local business has the routes in to those major contracts.
I think what I'd say, Paul, is I don't think any local business expects to get something for nothing.
Because they won't get out of us.
But I also think that, you know, when you talk about value for money, then clearly it doesn't take a genius to work out that if we can secure some of those contracts for local firms, local employment follows, the money stays in the local economy, and so on and so forth. So there's value for money benefit there. I think also that what I felt is that though there is an acceptance that that sort of process and procedure is good, once the conversation has ended, there doesn't appear to me to be a culture within the City Council, or indeed, I have to say, within the Housing Association or RSL movement across the city region, that demonstrates a leadership that then continuously campaigns for that sort of approach and actually brings people in and includes companies in how the procurement service is being established, what processes are being set up, and how local firms can actually set up processes of their own that would make them more attractive and competitive in that market. You know, you mentioned road surfacing. Two great manufacturing companies in this city that have been around for a long, long time, both got great track records in the kitchen industry. That's No Name Capricorn Kitchens and Panorama Kitchens. Both of those firms struggle greatly with the need to go through the very complicated and complex systems that are in place at the moment. And I just wonder whether a new administration would actually look at setting up some sort of forum, if you like, to bring those people in, give them advice and guidance and support as to how they can get through some of those, you know, let's face it, challenging bureaucracies for SMEs.
Yeah, I think anything we could do that would facilitate local business getting access to those contracts, we would certainly consider doing. I don't want to suggest that we, influential though I might be, if I was deputy leader of the council, could necessarily at a single stroke get rid of the European procurement rules that cover the whole of the EU. And they are there for a good reason, to enable Merseyside companies to tender for contracts in south of Greece, maybe a bad example at the minute, Italy or France or wherever. And indeed, we have some major enterprises based here in Liverpool that have a worldwide reach. You know, we need to look at Shop Direct and the Littlewoods Corporation, and we've just had the UK HQ of Maersk relocate here to the waterfront. So we do. This is a two-way street. However, where I think people do sometimes find themselves being tangled up in red tape is if they are seeking to work in partnership with others who are big enough to enter into those direct relationships, and the council and indeed other public procurers have a responsibility, in my view, to make sure they do all that they can to ease the path of local businesses towards those contracts, because most of the time I would say those contractors want to do what the procuring bodies want, and if the procuring bodies tell them we want to get local staff, they will do what they can, but they often unintentionally present a whole series of obstacles for people, and dialogue is the best way of trying to remove those obstacles.
Absolutely. I suppose the other thing that the business community will be aware of is that Liverpool has had a rather tetchy relationship with past Conservative governments, to say the least. And therefore, if, as is suggested in some quarters, we do have a Conservative government following the general election, how would that affect Liverpool City Council, particularly if it was a Liverpool City Council led by a Labour administration?
Well, I'm just going to wash your mouth out with soap and water for suggesting a Tory government. But if the unthinkable was to happen, my personal view is that we don't want a repeat of what happened in the 1980s. There was a tale of two cities in the 1980s. Liverpool stood up proud and resisted vocally the Tory government and went had a lot of loudspeaker, megaphone diplomacy, and frankly, it didn't do the city a great deal of good. Manchester opposed the Tories on a political level, but worked within the framework that was given to them. And frankly, I think they stole a march on us over that time period. I will inevitably significantly disagree with an awful lot of Tory party policy if they were to come into power. But if they are to offer us some opportunities, I mean, I'm thinking about the old enterprise action zones that used to take place, or single streams of funding that might be available to areas in the north, I think we need to try and capture what little may be still left on the table to us and work to maximise the benefit for Liverpool. I do genuinely believe it would be a disaster for the UK as a whole, and Liverpool in particular, if we had a Tory government. But I think that we must deal with whatever the electorate as a whole gives us to deal with. And if the Tories are elected nationally, it's incumbent on us as city custodians to make sure we try and achieve the best out of that circumstance that we possibly can.
I mean, you mentioned earlier Liverpool this year got a significant and generous settlement from central government. That isn't likely to happen next year, whoever wins, I guess. But we've seen in the past, didn't we, this standoff between Labour councils, not just in Liverpool, it has to be said, but I suppose Liverpool high-profile-wise, and the Tory government. Basically, what you're saying, Paul, is that ain't going to happen again.
Well, there'll be a bit of wailing and gnashing of teeth, I'm quite sure. If it didn't come from me, as it will, but even if it didn't come from me, it would come from many others in the city. But I think that we also have to be realistic and accept that under a democratic system, you don't always get those who you want to deal with. But if the electorate as a whole give us a Tory government to deal with, I think it's incumbent on us to try and maximise the benefits for Liverpool out of that relationship. And I would hope that the Tories as well would realise that having a city like Liverpool crushed in the way that we were, or some of its industries were, under the last Tory government, certainly didn't help Liverpool, but it didn't actually help them either. Mm. And if they want to try and project a less hard image than the one that everyone in the city is well accustomed to, it would do them some benefit to cut us some slack as well.
Paul Brandt, Deputy Leader of the Labour Group on Liverpool City Council, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, that's it from me, Frank McKenna, and City Talks Business for another week. Thanks to my guests. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. And don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.